one thing that was really important to us is that we understood if people would perceive this digitization of theatre content, you know, moving it to a digital platform, did they perceive that as a threat to traditional theatre? Pretty much everybody has so far said that they do not think it will be a threat. They think that it's something that can go hand in hand and can be a substitute or a pipeline, but it cannot be a replacement.
Hey everybody, thanks for checking out our podcast, Understanding Our Place in the World. The podcast is brought to you by the Department of Psychology at the University of Essex. My name is Philip Cosolino, and I am an experimental social psychologist at Essex, and my guest today is Dr. Abigail Webb, a cognitive scientist at Essex. Much of Abby's early work focused on facial expressions in the contexts of fear, threat, and attraction. Her more recent efforts are exploring the immersive potential of virtual reality in the context of theater and the arts. Abby and I spoke recently about a number of topics, including the can of worms, as she called it, that is evolutionary psychology and mate selection, as well as how and if virtual exposure to theater can provide a meaningful experience for the viewers and maybe even provide a much-needed lifeline for the struggling live arts industry. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Well, Abby, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on today.
Thank you for having me.
So why don't you step back a little bit, like we always do, and tell the listeners, tell me a little bit about your background, where you're from, and sort of what educational experience you had that led you to become a psychologist.
Yeah, so I studied everything, actually, at the University of Essex. I did my undergraduate degree there in psychology. Towards the end of that, I kind of got interested in research because my final year project looked at this evolutionary theory that women's mate preferences shift across the menstrual cycle in line with hormonal shifts. This idea that you prefer certain facial traits in a potential mate when you're most fertile. So I looked at that for my third year project and continued that in a master's. And my master's kind of led me into face perception research, which was the foundation of my PhD. I looked at areas of face perception. In particular, I was looking at facial or perceptual biases for different facial expressions, mainly with a focus of the threat bias. So this idea that fearful faces are especially salient to the human visual system because they indicate imminent threat. And so I was looking at that kind of theory, but using a visual psychophysics approach in terms of the techniques. So looking at low-level visual processes that might underpin that and, kind of looking for a potential mechanism.
Let's step back for a second. Let's go. So the undergrad work, your final year project, which led to a master's, which kind of folded into the master's project, it sounds like. My memory, I don't know. I know a little bit about sort of like the Gangestad. Is that sort of one of the names there? Some maybe Buss. I can't remember. Some of the evolutionary psychologists who, I remember one of them, maybe it was Gangestad, did something with shirts, like men wore shirts and then they sweat in the shirts and then they gave the shirts to women and they tested whether or not as different parts of their cycle, were they attracted to the, right? This is you're sounding familiar. I'm not making this up.
Yeah, painfully familiar. Yeah.
Well, I do the relationships lecture in social psychology and have talked a little bit about some of these evolutionary perspectives. So what did you find? What was your, even if it was a null finding, whatever it was, tell me a little bit about what the undergrad / master's research in that domain found.
Are you ready for this can of worms?
Well, you know, it's a podcast, so whatever it is.
Okay, right. So it's very, so evolutionary psychology is obviously quite broad. And the kind of the very basis of it is this idea that our behaviors and cognitive mechanisms come from selective pressures. So this is during, I'm assuming, sort of Pleistocene era. So when we were all early humans. And my area of research started with this, like you said about the Gangestad, I think I've pronounced that wrong. This idea that females have this kind of suite of hormonally driven changes in their preferences. And those preferences might come from, as you say, scent, but also from kind of visual preferences in terms of the structure of a male face. And so obviously the menstrual cycle is typically around 28 days. And the peak of ovulation is right in the middle, around day 14. And when you have that peak in estrogen, that's when you get this, that's when you, in theory, that's when you get these kind of shift or this kind of really, I guess, shift towards certain facial features that indicate a good mate. And this all kind of goes back to this idea that I think this is mentioned in quite a few Dawkins books as well, that females, they're described as being coy. So females, because they've got this, they biologically, it's basically all on them. If you females are born with a limited number of eggs, we have a finite time for our optimum fertility. And when we get pregnant, we are pregnant for 9 months. That's a huge biological investment. And it's a really heavy going one as well, because it's no easy feat to be pregnant for that length of time. But then also once the infant is born, but human babies are awful. They are rubbish. They cannot do anything. And so it's the female which has got to nurture that and make sure that the infant doesn't die, because the whole point of reproducing, evolutionarily speaking, is that you have your genetic legacy that you pass on to your offspring. By the time that a woman has gotten pregnant, had a baby, raised that infant into being a level of kind of independent where they're not going to wander off and get eaten by a saber-toothed cat, a male could already have impregnated X number of women. Infinite, potentially, you know, number of women. So the genetic output for males is greater than that of females. So this idea that women can be choosy because they have to be choosy, they have to make sure that the infant that they produce has 50% of their genes. We also need to make sure that we females need to make sure that whatever other 50% is going into our offspring needs to be a decent genetic input. So when we're fertile, the idea is that we would look for males that have physical traits of good genes. And in the evolutionary psychology and literature, that can be anything from face width, nose width, physical
symmetry.
Traits. Symmetry, yeah, physical traits of good genes. And usually there's a theory that it's linked to testosterone. To be honest, this whole thing is kind of a minefield. This research was really popular sort of between the 80s and early 2000s, because it's this really, really wonderful, like, romantic idea to say that you could look at these really nuanced things that have, in theory, been present in women for ages, and that you can pin it down. But I mean, it's recently, in the last, I'd say, 20 years, there's been lots of findings that have kind of come out and said, actually, very little of this is true. And just because you can see it happening in birds, right, doesn't mean that it applies to humans as well. A lot of the early research that shows these cyclic shifts in female preferences, a lot of it is now just being debunked, and actually it's not true at all. It's a nice idea that you can take a really tangible evolutionary theory and then apply it to something that's so interesting that you just can't.
Yeah, but I was taught a lot of this work when I was getting my PhD many years ago, and it was, you know, it was exciting and controversial and interesting and all these kinds of things. And over the years, I do some of the work on the facial feature parts of it, the averageness effect of how, you know, that has links to symmetry and such, because the averageness effect does show up and it does occur. And I'm intrigued by that notion of how we have this sort of prototype averaged face, so that when we see a face, the rare time that we see a face that is symmetrical, because most of our faces aren't quite symmetrical, we go, oh, well, that's like the perfect face. That's the one I have sort of an image of that I've stored. I've created this average in my head. I think that's fascinating as a potential just sort of avenue to discuss, but I don't get into any of the other stuff, because I do feel like, again, I'm nowhere near as up on it as you are, but it has always felt to me tenuous. I worked with some people who did hip to waist ratio stuff as well as, yeah, I know, exactly.
And that's the thing that really sucks. It's that this is years and years and years of people's research. And I kind of felt like, I don't know if it's just me, but there seems to be something, like I said before, about evolutionary psychology that is super, super romantic, and it's just all so lovely. And if you all the theory just fits together so nicely, and then once it's really kind of I don't know, you just kind of, the illusion just breaks down when you realize that it's not there, and you can lose faith in the research. I mean, I only did this research for a couple of years, and I still felt really rubbish at the end of it to think that I'd been chasing after this mechanism. Because even though I wasn't looking at direct face preferences, I was looking for a mechanism on it. Because I kind of felt like I was in the safe territory there. I thought, okay, well, I won't look at face preferences. I'll look at shift in visual processing across the menstrual cycle. because maybe we become more sensitive to changes in contrast around peak fertility. And even though I didn't find that, I was just really kind of, it was really, really disappointing because I just thought, you know, everything is designed so meticulously and everything, I mean, everything that's out there at the moment that's there suggests that this probably should maybe probably be there. And it just wasn't.
Well, good. That can of worms was fun. All right, so let's move now to your PhD. Talk a little bit about the PhD work that you did.
So I kind of continued my master's research, but within a different area. So I went from kind of ditched female preferences and moved on to facial emotion perception from an evolutionary standpoint, using methods borrowed from visual psychophysics. So looking at the kind of basic visual processing, the spectral properties and characteristics of a face as an image that could make them especially salient, or how they, you know, how those properties are processed in the brain. So that was what I did for 3 years. And I used a variety of techniques to look at that. Eye movements, masking studies, which is basically where you present a visual stimulus to a participant, but you kind of conceal it from conscious awareness. So you prevent it from ever achieving that kind of conscious appraisal or reaching, being visually processed, but not being perceived. And there's that difference between those two. Yeah.
So all right, what were some of the takeaways? What were some of the sort of, if you can recall, in a sort of a bulleted list of the most important lessons you learned from that work?
In face perception research, a really large chunk of that is this idea that facial displays of kind of indicate threat. So it could be anger or surprise, fear. They elicit a different response compared to faces which are, you know, happy or look content or sad, because the idea is that these different facial expressions are universal. They have their own unique associated kind of function, this evolutionary function. Fearful faces in particular are unique to other threatening facial displays, because if I look fearful right now, this is hard to explain because it's over Zoom. If I look scared right now and look behind you, that could imply to you that there is something behind you that you need to be aware of. And when these mechanisms evolved, this was during Pleistocene era, so 300,000 years ago, when saber-toothed cats were a very real threat. And so you would know that I'm not a threat. I'm not a direct threat to you. Whereas I would be if I looked angry. If I look really angry right now, you need to decide whether or not you're going to punch me or run away. And yeah, looking behind you is something where you need to be, I guess, seeing a fearful face is kind of this alerting system. So you need to be ready to direct your attention away from me and to something else. And that's what we call the disengaging kind of effect. Forgetting what's in front of you and being super alert and vigilant to other visual stimuli that may crop up. So that effect, I think one of the take-home messages was that effect is very tricky to pin down. And obviously, with more technology and more understanding of how the visual system works, there are so many different tasks and techniques that you can use to assess these parts of face perception. And you will quite often get different findings depending on which one you use. So it seems to be that this threat bias of fearful faces is not this massive umbrella thing that you will find in every context, because you won't. If you're telling somebody to recognize a face, you might be better at recognizing positive facial expressions. It really depends. And one thing that did become quite clear, and I think, I mean, I'm probably biased, but I think the thing that was the most helpful that came from this is the realization that facial expressions as visual stimuli are really complicated. And if you're taking a low level approach, which is that you're assuming there is something about the face as a stimulus, as a signal, which is creating these cognitive biases, not the fact that you can say, yeah, I know that's fear, I know who's putting that fearful face. If you're taking that low level approach, then you need to be really careful with how you treat the face as an image in the first place. Because something that happens a lot in studies of face perception is you take all of your stimuli and you try and control for as many confounds as possible. So you might normalize them all in terms of brightness and size and everything, and this whole standardization process, which is what science is supposed to be. You kind of, you eliminate the stuff that you don't want to look at so that you can hone in on the thing that you really want to see. But the process of doing that makes fearful faces possibly all too similar to other faces. And so it's hard to tell whether or not these perceptual biases are for the image manipulations themselves or the faces themselves. So it's all messy, but the fact that we didn't get a clear answer, I think, is interesting in itself, because it has definitely, the take-home message was that this needs to be looked at more, and there is something really interesting going on here, but we just don't know what. The whole thing, the take-home message is that it's messy, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you're trying to capture evolutionarily built process, you know, as you say, for millennia, and you're trying to capture it like in a moment in a lab, right? And yeah. It's just, it's going to be messy, right? Otherwise, we would already know the answer.
Yeah, if we had time machines, this would all be so much easier.
The Hippodrome Theatre in Birmingham. Coronavirus has forced it to shut its doors for the first time in 125 years. The Book of Mormon set that's still on stage, an eerie reminder of the suddenness of the pandemic. And as nobody knows when theatres will be able to fill their seats again, it's an industry in crisis. This week, Southampton's Nuffield Theatre closed its doors for good. Others could follow.
Sort of the direction you're heading in now sounds to some extent completely different, but yet really important, I think, in the, of course, as we like to say, the age of COVID and this year that has just decimated the arts, performers, theater in general. They've been shut and around the world for obvious reasons, you know, congregate, you know, places where, you know, to sit next to each other for hours is something we haven't been able to do. So you have this new approach or this new interest in thinking about how you can get people to experience the arts. And I'm not saying it's completely linked to COVID, but it's certainly, I think, relevant to what's going on in the world of art today. So why don't you talk a little bit about what you're doing now?
For part of my postdoc, I was supposed to start looking at virtual reality, obviously with face perception, not with theatre. Obviously, the closure of labs meant I couldn't do that. And it just so happened, it was all kind of serendipity.
Coincidence? Okay.
So I came across this company there, an online library for virtual theatre content. And I just thought, oh, this is a really cool idea. I'll contact the founder and see if I get a response, kind of expecting not to. And Leo Kelbron Parker, he did reply, and we had some interesting discussions about theatre and virtual reality. And initially it started off as being interested in, you know, just kind of talking about what immersion is really like. So when you read the book of something, in particular I was interested in this Virginia Woolf, because they have a performance there that is a one-woman show of Dalloway. And I was really interested in kind of, if you read the book, which is in theory, when you're reading a book, that's like the best immersion that you can possibly have, because you're not aware of things going on around you and you're really in one reality but also in another. And when you watch the same performance, when you watch it in the form of a theatre performance, are you immersed in the same way as you would be in a book? I suspect probably not. It's probably different. So we were talking about that, and then I thought that perhaps it would be nice to apply for some external funding, which was successful. So the study that we're doing at the moment is funded by the UKRI Impact Accelerator Award. And we wanted to know how you can use virtual reality theatre. So that is theatre that you watch at home using a virtual reality headset, how you can use that as kind of a pipeline for theatres to continue to reach audience groups. And not just because of COVID, but even pre-COVID, you have restricted audiences who can't get to the theatre because of financial restrictions, box office prices are too much, physical disabilities, the process of going to the theatre, where even if you're fortunate enough to not have any physical disability, if you want to get to your seat, you have to, there's an awkward moment of being like, oh, hi, could you, everyone has to stand up and then you have to squeeze past. And it's just physically not a straightforward process. So we wanted to know how this could be used as kind of a pipeline for reaching those underserved audiences. But then obviously, because of COVID, theatres have started to stream some of their performances online. They've done live, one of our local theatres, the Ipswich Wolsey Theatre, they did live stream their pantomime. But then also you've got the other side, so you've got 2D streaming, which is not live, pre-recorded shows that are streamed live by, say, the the National Theatre. And so there is this kind of movement now towards having a digital strategy that works for everyone. And what we are really interested in is how this kind of virtual theatre could be effective, not just during COVID, but after COVID as well. Because if a theatre has got archived material, it makes sense to maximise the reach and the impact of that material.
You're saying archived material. I assume, though, for full immersive experience with the headsets and such, wouldn't that require certain types of recording material, right? I assume to get the full experience, it would doesn't it have to be recorded in a way that's meant for those devices?
So if you're doing something like what the National Theatre have done, then you can just record it on a very sophisticated camera and that's decent enough to be able to rewatch it. But if you want to capture a performance that's then suitable for virtual reality or 360 streaming, then you need to have a camera that captures it slightly different. So effectively, depending on what you're using, you might have two cameras. And the idea is that it creates this 3D impression of the virtual theatre in the same way as your brain would create that impression of the theatre if you were actually there. So we have two eyes and those, so binocular vision by being meaning two. And so that image from is slightly different in one eye compared to the other. But by binocular fusion, we combine those two different inputs together to create a 3D representation of the world. And that's basically what a camera would do as well. When that gives you the ability to see a performance happening in 3D, and with the 360 benefit, you can look around as well. So there's one performance that Nivar have, for example, I cannot remember the name of it, but there is some performers on the stage at the front and there's another section of the show at the back. And so you can just turn your head and watch them go backwards and forwards. And what's really nice about that is that you can see other people in the audience, because Nivar have filmed most of their material before COVID. Obviously you had a room full of audiences, and so sure, you still have a degree of that social fix.
So I assume then you're also hearing the audience reactions. So it's almost as if it's just planted right in the middle of the theater without having that annoying, excuse me moment, but you're there and you're hearing whatever it is that was coming from the audience as well as the stage. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And you've seen some of these then, you've seen at least a couple. What's your take on it? I mean, we could talk about if you have data from participants at this point, but personally, what was your experience? Did it feel like a unique experience that wasn't the same, or were you, for moments in time, did you feel like I'm at a theater and I'm watching this as if I was there?
So the performance that I'm an uncultured swine. I don't go to the theater all that much, or I didn't before COVID. But there is a performance on there by Dyad Productions, which is called Dalloway, and it's a one woman show. And I think that because it's a one woman show, and because it's a lot of direct text from Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway, if you've read it, you'll know that it's very stream of consciousness. She will go for ages and ages and ages before there's a full stop. And so the performer is reading this very dense dialogue. And so because you're really in that and you're really concentrated on what she's saying, and it almost sounds really cheesy, but to a degree, because of the stream of consciousness of it, you're almost feeling it as she's describing it. And I think because I was so fixated on that, I did become very immersed very quickly. But it was really nice to take moments to kind of look around at the kind of like, you know, the faces in the dark around you, and to see what they were thinking and if they were smiling and if they, you know, really, really kind of like looking, you know, really concentrating on what they were looking at. That was really nice. I think that the novelty of that wears off after a time, because you can't nudge someone next to you and be like, oh yeah, that was my favorite bit from the book or something. There's a ceiling, I think, to the social element that you get from it. But in terms of the visuals, it's really, really good. Really, really very good.
It's an interesting distinction, right? Because, I mean, we all watch movies, especially this past year. We've been Netflixing and doing everything that we can to find interesting content to fill the days. But there, when you go to a performance, a theater, whether it's theater or a gig, a concert, whatever it might be, you can't, I think, I mean, I've been a performer in my life, and I feel as if you can't separate what's being performed with being a part of the audience watching the performance, right? That's part of why it's unique. It isn't the same thing as sitting in a theater or in your living room watching a movie, it's part of the experience of being at a show, a performance, is that I'm amidst this big group of other human beings and we're having this shared emotional experience together. So it feels to me like with the technology, there might be a ceiling to what the benefit is there, but it really is quite important, I'd imagine, to not just capture well what the performance is, but actually to my argument might be, it almost becomes more important to how do you maximize that shared audience experience if you want to get the true theater experience. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. And I think that that is one of the limitations of this. I don't think you can get that social benefit from, and you can't get it in real time from this because it's just not what the technology can do right now. But it's the same, you can get the same social fix that you can get as you would normally watch TV shows. One of the best, if there's a TV series that you've really enjoyed or a movie that you've really enjoyed, one of the best things I think is being able to talk about that enjoyment with somebody else, a friend who has also enjoyed that. And that's what you do. I mean, if you watch a movie months ago and then you meet somebody at a barbecue or something, and you start talking about it, and you're like, oh, have you seen this? And yeah, I've seen this. And oh my God, it's so good. Did you see this bit? And did you know this? And that's something you can still have that experience, but just not at the time of watching it. But it's still, you still get that affirmation that afterwards that you've had that shared experience.
In the old days, when there were, people would say, okay, this television show is on, it's on every Thursday at 9 p.m. and the world or the nation that it aired in sat down and watched the show. Even if you were in your living room by yourself, you felt kind of, we're doing this, everyone's watching this. This is the hottest show, whatever it might be, ER, Friends, from my American experience many years ago. But you felt, now it's such a strange thing, right? Because as you say, with streaming on demand content, yeah, you're watching something, even if we're both watching the same show, I don't know what episode you're on. We're not binging at the same time. So it's what we're having, these artistic experiences. We're engaging in these television shows or movies or performances, whatever it might be, but we're not really feeling like, and we have to be careful, like, oh, I don't want to spoil something for you, or please don't spoil it for me. So it is a very different kind of way of exposing ourselves together to art by saying we're kind of watching it together, but we're not really together. And in fact, we're not even in sync as we're experiencing it. Maybe this is a subtle, meaningless distinction, but I think a really interesting part of how we sort of have the cultural experience of art.
But I don't think it is meaningless, because this is something that streaming platforms have already picked up on and is already a thing. I mean, like, there's Netflix Party now, and the whole point of that is that you there's a guaranteed live experience that you're watching it with another household, for example, and that me and some friends, we will watch something over Zoom, and the way we do it is really backward, because we'll have like Zoom on the laptop and then we'll just count down from three. But there is a more sophisticated way of doing it, and you can there's Netflix Party, and I know my daughter, she's been using Disney Plus to watch Guardians of the Galaxy and stuff. So there are ways of doing it, and the fact that these really big platforms like Disney Plus and Netflix, the fact that they are now creating ways for that to happen implies that there is a big enough demand and it is important. So I think that when it comes to this immersive theater side, and it's been difficult because the participants in the study, we really wanted to make sure that we just captured how good this is at the individual level, because if we had some people who did it together, two people, a couple watching a movie watching a performance, and they gave us feedback, was like, oh, we really enjoyed it, compared to somebody who watched it alone, that's going to then confound things. So it would have been really nice to have looked at how people watching a performance together using headsets would have enjoyed this. And that's one of our questions. One of our questions to participants afterwards is, would you have enjoyed this experience more had you have been able to watch it with somebody else at the same time? And the answer almost always is yes.
So let's talk a little bit about the data that you do have. How is the experience? I mean, how many people have you, basically? How many participants so far? What is their response to this virtual theater experience?
We've probably got 150 people who have completely finished this, and there's probably about 50 more people who are still doing this and that we're yet to recruit. And so they haven't formally analyzed any data yet, but just looking at the kind of face value of what we have, it really seems to be a kind of Marmite effect where people either really, really love this or they really, really don't. But one thing that is really clear from this is that the vast majority of people agree that this is a really good way, even if it's not for them, even if they haven't especially enjoyed it, they agree that it is a really good idea to use as a pipeline for theatres to continue reaching audiences, including underserved audiences. And one thing that was really important to us is that we understood if people would perceive this digitization of theatre content, you know, moving it to a digital platform, did they perceive that as a threat to traditional theatre? And because, you know, that's kind of the knee-jerk response that you get with things like, you know, Kindle moving, you know, will Kindle be the death of real books and physical books? And pretty much everybody has so far said that they do not think it will be a threat. They think that it's something that can go hand in hand and can be a substitute or a pipeline, but it cannot be a replacement. That's what people are very firm about. One participant described it as it scratches the itch. But it can never replace the real thing, because the real thing is almost a kind of social ritual of, you know, drinks beforehand and drinks after. Sure. And yeah,
arts are in trouble. They were probably even before we got to COVID, but COVID certainly has damaged them.
Yeah, I mean the Arts Council have been incentivizing the kind of expansion of digital offering for a while now, and I don't necessarily think it was because I this is not my area of expertise, but I don't think it was because they wanted a plan B for if there was a pandemic. I don't think that was what they were thinking about, but it was more for making sure that they had a digital offering for audiences that were not the typical audience that could just wander along to the theatre whenever they liked. Because if you're, you know, if you really care about the art that you're producing, you should want it to have as big a reach as possible. But that raises loads of really interesting questions in itself, even from the business side of things. Like when you're able to offer essentially what is a product to more people, then how do you monetize that? Because then it's a bit of a trade-off in terms of the large reach, but then also how much you're then charging for that, and making subsidies for people who can't afford it. Because if you're saying that you want to make it more affordable for people who can't, you know, go to a West End show, then you need to make sure that you've got some kind of subsidy at the level of the box office somewhere.
You know, it's like, so it's this notion of, well, how, all right, let's get everyone somehow access to it, but how are we going to be able to still get funded to do it? It's an interesting music, art, theater. It's a really interesting time, because I feel like people want things, they want to be entertained for either free or very little bits of money.
Now, I can imagine that must be really difficult, because if you are a performer in the arts at whatever level, if your job is to entertain and to, if you have such an important role in kind of social connectedness and even just, you know, kind of keeping people engaged and invested in something, and you can't do that during COVID because your platform has been taken away, I can imagine that must be really difficult, because then you've got to find a balance between, I mean, A, how do you even get out there in the first place? But then, how do you make a living? Because you have to pay your rent or your mortgage, right? But then there's also the aspect of what you do is important, and you want it to still be able to reach people, but it can't be for free.
I love the idea of that middle ground of saying, well, we're not just trying to put something on, you know, a player that you can stream it on your phone. We're trying to put you there, and maybe even get people to realize, oh my gosh, I haven't been a theater goer, but I want to be now, because this immersive experience in virtual reality was so cool that I want to take the next step and actually have the real experience. I have to imagine that's part of their hope.
Yeah, and that's something that we've included in this study. One of the things that we ask people is, has this changed the way that you feel about traditional theatre? Does it make you feel more likely to want to go to the theatre, you know, disregarding COVID, once COVID has hopefully one day passed? And resounding yes. This makes people want to, and it's not that the experience is so terrible or such a terrible substitute that it makes them want to go back. It just reminds them of how good it is to go to the theatre. And yeah, that's been quite nice. And I know that echoes what was found with National Theatre Live. There was this kind of concern that if you move to online streaming, then what incentive are people going to have to actually go to a theatre auditorium? But actually it can reel in audiences that otherwise wouldn't have been interested necessarily in going, or maybe they didn't realise that it was the sort of thing that they were into.
You said the Marmite, some people love it, some people hate it. The virtual immersive experience of live theater, great. But let's focus on these some people hate it. Do you have any way of knowing at this point? Is it too early to be analyzing data? Which, if you're not done, it is, I guess. But do you have a sense of, is that we don't like it part of the equation, people who are theater goers, right? Or is it not systematic in that way?
No, so one thing that has become quite clear is that different mobile devices have very different GPUs. And sometimes it is just the case that one participant is using a slightly older device and the GPU just isn't sufficient enough to give the potential, perhaps the resolution isn't as great as somebody using it, say, on, you know, a device that was bought within the last 6 months. It seems to be that, and that's going to be something that I need to think about when it comes to cleaning the data, to what, you know, what is the cutoff point going to be. But that seems to be the main driver of why people dislike it. The only other thing that follows after that is that some people just do not fare well in virtual environments. Some people.
Oh, is it uncomfortable for some people?
It's a very small minority of people. So actually there's kind of two important things to mention here. One is that obviously some people just don't do well with being in that kind of virtual space where you've got the disconnect between the real physical world and then the visual illusion that you are in. And for some people, they can get dizzy. That's not uncommon at all. That's not anything that's wrong with this. This is just something that how some people cope. Other people can get something what's called, I think, VR legs, which is where they take the headset off and then suddenly they feel a bit kind of weird and dizzy and moving around is strange because you've got a different visual input and suddenly you're in. I'm guessing it's probably of a very similar effect to what happens when you, if you get travel sickness. There's a mismatch between the visual information you receive and the information from your body. But on the other side of things, what has been very clear about this is that if you want to make sure that this is a good pipeline for underserved audiences, people who are facing an issue or a disability that prevents them from going to the theatre as other people do, then one thing that has cropped up is that for some people who struggle with sensory overload, this is not useful. It's really weird as well. It differs. I mean, an example is people with autism. If you have autism, you can struggle with sensory overload, things being too loud, things being too much at once. And it's strange because one participant told us in the interview that her son or her daughter has autism, and they had absolutely loved using the headset and the theatre experience. And they really enjoyed it. It was really good for them. It really helped them to just kind of hone in and just what was going on in front of them. There was another individual, lady who had MS, and something that she really struggled with was the kind of sensory overload that she got from being in that immersive environment. And it's so strange that you can have, obviously those are two completely different conditions, but when you struggle with something like sensory overload, this could be or could not be a useful thing for that. I mean, the feedback was really useful because what was clear from that participant was that this concept of immersive theatre, the thing itself was great and it was really enjoyable, but she just couldn't enjoy it to the extent that she wanted to be able to because of the kind of, I guess, almost claustrophobic aspect of it for her. Whereas for some people, that's what they need. They need that to be able to really invest in what they're watching.
So where is this now? I mean, is it something that people, is it only through this project that you have? Is there a portal that exists for people that want to investigate and for themselves that they can go on and, is there a subscription for it? I mean, how does this work for the public right now?
Sure. So in terms of the study, we have finished participant recruitment. We only have about 10 spaces left and we are reserving those for people who kind of fit into the category of being underserved audiences. In terms of the content and the platform that we've been using to conduct study, that's Liver. And Liver are great. They've got about 70 different performances from different production companies, small to big scale ones. What you can do is you can subscribe to them and then they will send you a free headset It's worth making sure that your phone has got a GPU, which is going to give you the best experience possible. And you have, it's kind of like a credit system. You each performance costs you a credit, and that's what you, that's how it works. And you can watch it as many times as you like for up to 30 days afterwards. It's really worth looking at. There are some really great performances on there.
The part of this that strikes me as the most interesting is less about the interesting virtual experience of the art itself, but the putting people in that group social experience seems to be the most important part.
Yeah. And that's something that would be really great to explore. I think, especially at the moment, I think people are, I mean, I know there's a bit of fatigue with the third lockdown, but I would like to think that there would be more motivation for trying these new kind of platforms for connecting with people from afar. And I think, and you know, if you're, everything that's come out from this pandemic, all the, you know, the fallout in terms of mental health, I think that that's hopefully going to be a motivator for finding other kind of pathways that we can continue to be not just social with people, but, you know, the arts are great for engagement and giving somebody a focus and a kind of creative outlet. And just, or, you know, just kind of reminding somebody that they're not alone in what they feel. If this could be a way in which that could happen, or to help people to kind of reassure people of that, then I think that would be good. And that's something I'm hoping to kind of find from this. I think a researcher in virtual reality predicted that in 5 to 10 years, it'll be commonplace to have a headset in your house. So the closer we move towards that, the kind of more efficient financially these things will become. And maybe, yeah, who knows what will be done on virtual reality platforms, but it definitely does have good applications because you can bring what you want straight into somebody's house. It's, yeah.
All right, Abby, thanks for coming on. I enjoyed that conversation. I hope you did too.
Yeah, I did. It was great. I will always be happy to talk about research.
Congratulations on the grant and on the project, and keep us informed, all right?
Thanks.
And thank you once again for checking out the Understanding Our Place in the World podcast. This podcast was produced by the Department of Psychology at the University of Essex. Make sure to check us out again, as we'll have another interview for you to enjoy in the coming weeks.